This is Scripture on Creation with Dr. Ben Scripture. With a Master of Divinity, a PhD in biochemistry, and over 30 years of experience studying and teaching about creation, he is well equipped to discuss biblical and scientific perspectives on creation, science, and intelligent design. This and past programs are also available as a free podcast, so you can listen anytime. And now, here is Scripture on Creation.
Thank you and welcome to Scripture on Creation. I'm Scott Kump.
And I'm Dr. Ben Scripture.
Dr. Scripture, you recently finished a Scripture on Creation conference at a church in North Augusta, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And you said during the Q&A sessions, you received a number of good questions that you wanted to share and address in today's program.
Yes, Scott, I enjoyed 4 days of meetings at the North Augusta Bible Chapel and also had a wonderful time with a group of homeschool children. And at the end of one of the sessions, a gentleman in the audience named Heath said he had occasional opportunities to talk with people who were convinced to varying degrees of the truth of evolution. Of course, there are a number of different evidences you can bring up in a conversation with someone in that position, but usually there's going to be a limited amount of time to present something from a creation point of view. So he wanted to know what I thought was the single best piece of evidence to bring up in a situation like that.
Oh, that is a good question. Very practical and would probably be helpful to a lot of people. So what was your answer?
Well, to be honest, I was torn. I've been asked similar questions. And what I can't help but think about is what kind of background or interests that person who believes in evolution has. For example, to me, because of my background and interest in life science, molecular biology in particular, the evidences that speak loudest to me are those that have to do with the biochemistry of organisms. Their complexity and interdependency and precision and function, in my mind, unmistakably refute evolution's claim that mutation and random chance cause the existence and diversity of life, because I have an understanding of the significance of much of it. But for others, they don't understand what all is involved. So that kind of evidence isn't as meaningful to them. On the other hand, a person schooled in geology would be more impressed with evidences for creation from maybe radiometric dating or rock strata.
Okay, so you were torn, Dr. Scripture. Did you pick what you think is the one single best piece of evidence, or did you hedge and give more than one answer?
Well, Scott, as much as I would rather the pinnacle piece of proof come from an RNA molecule, I chose evidence from the field of paleontology.
Ah, from the fossils.
Yes, although there is a biochemical component related to that evidence I picked.
Okay, with that clue, I'm going to steal your thunder and guess. Yeah, I'm going to guess that you said the single best piece of evidence to challenge evolution theory is soft tissue in dinosaur fossils.
Oh, Scott, that's right. Well, if there's limited time or opportunity to discuss creation versus evolution with an evolutionist, or even a person who accepts evolution to varying degrees, I think the evidence that would make the biggest impact would probably be the existence of unfossilized dinosaur tissue being found in dinosaur fossils.
Now, don't take it too hard, Dr. Scripture. After all, like I said, I guessed what you were going to say because you pointed out that even though it was an evidence from the field of paleontology, biochemistry was involved.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't you say that it's the biochemistry aspect of soft tissue in dinosaur fossils that's the crucial feature, resulting in it being evidence for creation?
Well, Scott, now that you put it that way, you're absolutely right.
Great.
Life science triumphs again.
That's right.
Not that it's a competition. But as you point out, it's the nature of the organic materials that have remained unfossilized that call into serious question the claims, in fact, the insistence by evolutionists that at a minimum, a dinosaur bone buried in the earth is 65 million years old. But organic material, whether protein or nucleic acid or carbohydrates, cannot maintain its chemical integrity for even a fraction of that time. The chemical bonds break down. For example, one of the toughest proteins known, cartilage collagen,
has a half-life of approximately 117 years. Yet visible, measurable amounts can be found in supposedly 100 million-year-old bones, and the organic material of blood cells and nerve fibers are far more fragile than collagen.
So given these observations about the nature of organic material, why is soft tissue in dinosaur fossils so damaging to evolution?
Well, it's not so much about what it says about the dinosaurs, but what the implications are for the entire system of dating the strata and fossils found in it. The interpretation of the measurements taken from the samples they collect are simply wrong. And not just a little. They are drastically flawed, and I submit totally untrustworthy. Therefore, the foundation the entire theory of evolution is built upon, that being all the changes that have taken place, whether geological or biological, took millions, no, billions of years, has no empirical basis. It's a concept essential to the theory to help one's imagination accept the idea that if you give something enough time, no matter how improbable or even impossible, it can happen.
You know, when you said that, I immediately thought of the statement by that professor of astrobiology at the University of Wisconsin who said, if you give it an environment, life is going to spontaneously develop. What clear-thinking person would believe that? Unless they assume that the newly developed life form had billions of years to eventually pop into existence. But that's nothing more than imagination. It surely isn't empirical science.
Imagination, indeed. But the theory of evolution depends heavily on imagination to overcome what is unwavering observation. So in my opinion, if you have the opportunity to share just one tidbit of information with an evolutionist, bring up the existence of unfossilized tissue in dinosaur bones and see where the discussion leads.
So, Dr. Scripture, I know you had other questions to discuss. What else were you asked during your meeting?
Well, I mentioned I had the opportunity to speak to some homeschooled children. I talked about astronomy and the Bible with them. And when I finished my presentation about the moon and stars and so forth, a delightful little girl in fourth grade, I think her name was Scarlett and she had red hair, timidly raised her hand and asked, Dr. Ben, have you ever been in space? Well, I had to chuckle because I wondered if she figured, given all that I had said, I must have been there. She was so cute. But when I said no, I hadn't been in space, one of the other students quickly asked, would you like to go into outer space?
Legitimate question.
And without giving any thought, I said, for sure. So how about you, Scott? Would you like to go into outer space?
You know, when I was a kid, I used to tell everybody I wanted to be an astronaut.
Oh, well, I guess so.
Well, and even as an adult, there are some things that appeal to me. I'd like to experience weightlessness. I'd like to look out a window and say, hey, there's the whole Earth. But when I think about how it affects bone density and other things physiologically, it makes me hedge a little bit.
Well, I'd love to look back down on Earth and see the curvature of the planet, the boundary between light and darkness the Bible mentions, and see the stars without having the light filtered by our atmosphere. And I'd imagine the heavens would seem larger for some reason. But going out into outer space in a little rocket ship with just a thin layer of metal between you and the vacuum of space, being stuck in a container that's certainly not very big, when I thought more about the idea of going into outer space, I'm not so sure I would jump at the chance.
Not right after watching Apollo 13.
Although they were okay, but at least not given the current conditions, I don't think I'd want to go into outer space.
You know, that's a good point. Those are not cruise liners they're launching into space. And there's no options for a return trip or catching a later flight. You are 100% dependent on the ship you're on to get back.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing, what do you think of being weightless?
I didn't even think about that when I answered them, Scott, because I get vertigo just from a virtual ride.
Oh, wow.
You know, we took two of our granddaughters to Disney World and rode the Space Mountain ride. I had to close my eyes about a third of the way through it because I was getting queasy. You know, weightlessness, maybe I better pass again on going into space.
Well, if you have a chance to talk to those kids again, you'll have to tell them you had a change of heart or stomach.
Yeah.
But the little girl's question about space didn't really address an educational idea. Do you have any questions more related to what you were teaching?
Well, yes. Some homeschoolers also attended the conference sessions in the evening. And in one of the sessions, after talking about the different roles DNA and RNA played in living cells, a 12-year-old girl, Autumn, asked what was the difference between DNA and RNA that enabled them to do such different things. Now, that's a thoughtful question, and from a 12-year-old, no less.
Yeah. So how did you answer her? I mean, there's the soundbite answer, and then there's a college textbook answer.
Well, I tried to shoot for something in the middle. I tried to explain the one most significant difference between DNA and RNA that resulted in them behaving so differently as biomolecules. First, the letters in their acronyms are helpful. RNA stands for R, ribo, N, nucleic, A, acid, ribonucleic acid. It's a pretty complex and very precisely shaped molecule. But what matters is it is formed from a string of units called nucleotides. Think of each nucleotide as a pearl. Then RNA is like a pearl necklace. Now, DNA stands for D, deoxyribo, N, nucleic, A, acid, deoxyribonucleic acid. The acronyms tell you the main chemical difference between the two types of molecules. DNA nucleotides are missing an oxygen atom that RNA nucleotides have. And that oxygen atom on the RNA pearl makes it behave very differently from DNA. Where DNA has a little stiffness to it, RNA is very flexible. RNA can fold into all kinds of complex shapes. But DNA will remain pretty much in an elongated tube. It bends, but not like RNA. Like the difference between an insulated phone charging cord and dental floss.
And that's just because RNA has an oxygen atom attached to it and DNA does not.
Pretty much. So the other thing the oxygen atom attached to RNA causes is the RNA string of pearls breaks apart very easily. Simply put, oxygen is chemically very active, so it reacts with compounds and ions and lots of different enzymes which break it down. DNA, on the other hand, without that reactive oxygen, is more chemically stable. The upshot of these differences is RNA, because of all the different shapes it can take, carries out a lot more functions than DNA. And RNA, the pearl necklace, is easily broken apart, and the pearls, the RNA nucleotides, are used over and over again to make different RNA molecules to carry out lots of different processes in the cell.
Dr. Scripture, you talked about that in previous programs, that RNA is the perfect recyclable material.
That's right.
And DNA is stable, which is necessary so its information is protected and can be accurately passed on from cell to cell and from parent to offspring. A beautiful example of design.
Or a colossal stroke of essential luck.
Same thing.
One of millions of strokes from a time and chance perspective. Who could have imagined a little oxygen atom
stuck on a pearl
could be so important? But as magnificent as DNA and RNA may be in design, imagine what heaven is going to be like. They all have the same architect. And with pearls in mind, in heaven, the Creator uses pearls like wood and gold like asphalt. Listen to Revelation 21, 19 and 21. The foundation stones of the city wall were adorned with every kind of precious stone, and the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each one of the gates was a single pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. And that's not what I say. That's what Scripture says.
Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed the program. If you would like to hear this or past episodes of the program, you can listen to them on our free podcast, Scripture on Creation. If you have comments or questions you'd like Dr. Scripture to answer, contact him by calling 574-551-1524 or by sending an email to scripture@scriptureoncreation.org.